Our founders envisioned a new America driven by optimism, opportunity, and strength. So confident were they in the America that they were advancing that they put on the seal, the great seal of the United States, Novus Ordo Seclorum, a new order for the centuries.
Catapult the propaganda.
Alien race to come down and threaten us.
The military industrial complex.
A highly funded yet unofficial government agency. Take the red pill.
If this were a dictatorship, it'd be a heck of a lot easier.
Welcome to PID Radio. I'm Derek Gilbert.
And I'm Sharon Gilbert. And we welcome you to our bunker. And we welcome you to what's going to become a Sunday regular feature, just the interview. So PID guest line. And today, Sunday the 7th of January.
That's correct.
Yes, it is.
Of 2007.
We have a very special guest.
He's the author of Red Moon Rising and a book that I highly recommend, available in ebook format, and also he's made it generously available at his website, The Giza Discovery, Peter Goodgame. Peter, welcome to PID Radio.
Hello. Thanks for having me.
Oh, we're so delighted to have you back, Peter. Ever since we have, I think we've had you on twice before. Does that sound right?
Yeah.
But whenever you're on here, I get tons of email.
Yep. Same. It's really an education every time we bring you on. And before we go too far, we should mention that your website, redmoonrising.com, I mentioned the website but not the address, and we highly recommend it for not just the books that were mentioned, but the articles that you've got compiled there as well.
Mm-hmm.
And one in particular that is very timely is we've been doing some digging into the change in the political climate here in the United States. Sharon was led to do some study into the Kabbalah. And as we talked about over the last week or so, overlaid the Tree of Life, the Kabbalist Tree of Life, on a map of Washington, D.C., and found a shocking degree of correlation.
And we sent that to you.
Yes, yes. That was the first time I've seen that done. I've seen many other Masonic connections to the D.C. Layout, but yeah, I'm surprised I hadn't come across that before. Sharon, you're the first that I know of that's made that connection. I think it's very obvious, very clear.
Well, you know, once you see it, it's a shocker, and I won't take credit for it. You know, if it's divine inspiration, then I'll give credit to God, and if I'm wrong, then I'll take the blame. But it's been tickling at the back of my brain for a while that map of Washington reminded me of something, and I've never really studied the Kabbalah before.
Same thing with me, and I never put two and two together.
Yeah, the other thing that it reminds me of is a cross-section view of the Great Pyramid, as far as the the chambers,
right, with the slanting passageways going up back and
right,
forth,
right. Yeah, there's something about that. It's not a perfect fit, but I've been taking a look at that too. We'll leave that aside for today. I would like to learn more about the Kabbalah. That's something you've really taken a long, hard look at.
Well, yeah, there was a time where I was really into this, and I bought a number of books, and I studied what all the experts had to say on it, and you know, the experts from a secular perspective, from an occult perspective, and then I bring it all together, you know, around my Christian perspective, and yeah, this research can be found in my article, The Divine Council and the Kabbalah, because the Divine Council, you know, the work that Mike Heiser has really been groundbreaking in, it all goes back to that. It all goes back to the fact that the nations of the world were handed over to the authority of the fallen angels. And the Kabbalah, to boil it all down, is simply a means to communicate with these fallen spiritual beings.
Can you tell us what the word Kabbalah means?
There's a couple of different interpretations. The one that I've read from Gershom Scholem, I think, is he's one of the main experts. He says it means to receive. So it's the idea that just this hidden knowledge, this hidden wisdom, that is only available, you know, for very serious, you know, spiritual seekers. If they reach out and ask for it and go out and try and receive this knowledge, it'll be given to them.
Mm-hmm. Now, what I find really interesting is that the Kabbalah studies all start out with saying you are looking at the Tree of Life.
Right, right.
I think of it as the tree of knowledge of good and evil.
Oh, sure, absolutely.
There is no life in that tree.
Yeah.
But it's definitely Gnostic doctrine.
That's what it all boils down to, and that's what Gershom Scholem, that's what he arrives at. That's his conclusion. It's just it's repackaged paganism through an Old Testament lens. It's a very superficial, packaging, mm-hmm. but... Yeah, it's pure paganism.
Now, there are 10 circles in that tree. Can you tell us what those are and what they mean?
The ten Sephiroth, and sometimes you'll see them with 11. But let's see, they're divided into three higher Sephiroth and three lower. Three higher and seven lower. The three higher are Keter, Chokhmah, and Bina, which are divine thought, wisdom, and spirit. Then you have the seven lower. The interpretations of these words are different, but you have Kesed, Geburah, Hod, Yesod, Tiferet, Netzach, and Malkuth, which are interpreted as kindness, strength, splendor, foundation, peace, eternity, and kingdom. And it's interesting this all comes, these seven lower Sephiroth, they're based on a passage from 1 Chronicles 29:11, which says, "Thine, O Lord, is the greatness and the power and the beauty and the victory and the majesty, for all that is in the heavens and the earth is thine. Thine is the kingdom, O Lord, and thou art exalted as head above all." So everything, every mystical interpretation that they arrive at, they find something in the Bible that they say it's based upon. So it is very deceptive. It's very deceptive.
It's very deceptive.
Now, is this a case of exegesis, of divining, or of interpreting Scripture, or is this a case of, I've forgotten what the opposite word is, of taking a concept and then pushing it into Scripture, forcing it onto Scripture?
It's absolutely the latter case. Yes.
Is it onto Jesus?
Maybe that's it. Onto Jesus. I've forgotten what the opposite word is, but selecting quotes to find proof texts mm-hmm. for whatever concept you want to
it's
assemble.
Not using or quoting Scripture; it's abusing Scripture.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, and. The history of this, I think, goes back right to the first century A.D., right after Israel was rejected, or after Israel rejected the Messiah, okay? It goes back. Now, you have all these teachers that are famous teachers of the Kabbalah. They supposedly all go back to Abraham, and Moses was supposed to be a great Kabbalist, and there was supposed to be this oral tradition that was handed down from generation to generation, but really it all springs up after the destruction of the temple in Jerusalem. And you have the last high priest of the temple, and then his disciple becomes head of the Sanhedrin afterwards. He was a real mystical thinker that's acknowledged as one of their, mystical leaders. And it's passed on down the line, this knowledge, and it's really one of their main heroes at the very beginning is this guy, Rabbi Akiva. Now, we know him historically because he was the guy that proclaims that Bar Kokhba was the Messiah.
Mm-hmm.
Okay?
Mm-hmm.
Are you familiar with the Bar Kokhba revolt?
I am. Yeah. I don't know if our listeners are. Could you just give us a real brief synopsis?
Well, this was about 135 A.D. after Jerusalem had been destroyed, for a number of years. But this was really the last Jewish revolt against the Roman Empire, and it was a lot of blood was spilled because he had this Bar Kokhba developed a group of followers, and he led a revolt against Rome, but it was crushed completely and totally. But it's interesting, if we look at the whole history of the Kabbalah down through the centuries, it's basically the history of one false Messiah after another. That's all it is. And what happened is after Jerusalem and the temple was destroyed, the Jews really thought that God had left them. Okay, in a sense, they were right. But what they did then is they went on a quest for God. They went on a spiritual quest. They wanted to make their own way back to God, but not the right way. So what they did is they turned to the angels themselves as a pathway to God. The problem is they got into contact with the fallen angels.
So in other words, God's not speaking to us anymore, so we need to go out into the spiritual realm and find him.
Mm-hmm. Yes, that's what happened.
Rather than repent and go back to the Old Testament and follow his commandments, rather than realize that Jesus Christ was the Messiah, is the Messiah.
Yeah.
So what means did they use to try to make contact with God?
Really, it was mystical. I don't know if there was really rituals or drug taking or that kind of sort, which is really the main part of shamanism as we know it. Pagan shamanism really involves the taking of drugs. That might have taken place, but it was really just meditation, deep meditation, and just reaching out and trying to cross that threshold and trying to make contact with the spirit world. But you even see this thing in the New Age practices today, though, where people say that as long as you concentrate hard enough and you focus on reaching out either, to your higher self or to angels or to extraterrestrials or what have you, they say that as long as you do it hard enough and you're sincere, you will make contact. And I think that's what happened.
You know, as a personal note, and I don't know if this is officially taught, it probably isn't, but just as a personal note, that was something that was recommended to a group that I was in, a class in which I had to take in order to convert and become part of the Roman Catholic Church. The priest leading the class said that transcendental meditation was not necessarily a bad thing and could be very helpful for calming you. And I just found that, in retrospect, at the time I wasn't, educated enough or wasn't thinking enough about it to make any connections there or think it. But in retrospect, that's very odd. So, but anyway, they decided to focus, to meditate, to try to reach out to God. How did it Kabbalah grow out of this?
Well, the Bar Kokhba revolt was a disaster. It was a complete disaster. Okay, this is really, after this, you had a kind of a split within Judaism. I think the whole mystical tradition was greatly discredited, as it rightly should have been. And then this is when the whole Jewish system was set up around the synagogue, and the big Jewish center became the area of Babylon, okay? But there was still this underground current of mysticism, but it took probably another, 7 or 8 centuries for it to regrow and to pick up steam. People realized that these mystical practices were very dangerous, and it became established that people would not be given this kind of information until they had reached 40 years old. It was not to be offered to anybody except married Jewish males who were 40 years old and who had a thorough knowledge of the Torah. Only then would they be given this so-called deeper knowledge of the Kabbalah.
Now that's changed today, hasn't it? Because you don't have to be.
Yeah,
Jewish
you have hardcore Kabbalists. Yeah, you have hardcore traditional Kabbalists, I guess, if you can use that phrase. But who really say that this whole mass marketing of like pop Kabbalah that that people like Madonna and Britney Spears or whoever are involved in, they really look down on this because they say that these people are not spiritually progressed enough to receive this kind of higher wisdom. So there's all different types of Kabbalists, but there is a lot of people look very negatively on how the Kabbalah is making a resurgence today.
So the Bar Kokhba revolt kind of put the kibosh on things for a while and drove the mystic aspect of Judaism underground. Did it find root in Babylon, or did it spread out to other parts of the Roman Empire?
It did eventually spread out. It spread out from what Skolem traces it. He says it spread out like 8th or 9th centuries, and he's able to refer to several well-known mystical teachers that were based in Babylon. They were under the authority of the Arab Muslim Empire at the time. I forget the name of that, or the kingdom at that time, but it flourished for a time under the Arabs, under Muslim rule. And then there was a big transfer about the 9th century. There was a powerful family that ended up in Italy, a powerful Jewish family, the Coloni Medes family, something like that. But then from there it was transferred into Italy. And then from there it spread into Germany and became associated with the Hasidic movement, and which really grew up in like the 11th and 12th centuries. It also spread to Spain and to southern France in the same area where the Cathar heresy emerged, which was brutally suppressed by the Roman Catholics later on.
Interesting.
You have all these different things converging at the same time. It's all repackaged paganism. But you have the Kabbalah emerging at the same time Gnosticism was emerging. Gnosticism is a New Testament heresy. The Kabbalah is an Old Testament heresy.
Okay. All right. Now, the development of the Kabbalah as it's in medieval Europe. Is that where you first start to see this tree of life idea pop up?
Well, yeah, this is when the major books that are affiliated with Kabbalah finally emerge into the light of day. This is kind of where all the information is gathered, consolidated, and published. You have a number of books, and they're all, of course, they're said to be the teachings of some of these earlier teachers, of these earlier mystical guys like Rabbi Akiva, Rabbi Jonathan, who was the disciple of one of the last high priests. Anyway, it's all like pseudonymous kind of work here, or not pseudonymous. What's the word for it?
Pseudo-epigraphical.
Anyway, describing it. Yes, epigraphical. But anyway, one of the first major books is called the Behir, which means bright. Okay, and this is one that really sets out the whole Tree of Life diagram, and goes on into that line of thinking. But it's interesting that when this arrived, though, there were many rabbis who rose up at the time and said that there is nothing good about the Behir. I could give you one quote here. A rabbinical critic of the whole movement, Kabbalistic movement at the time, his name was Isaac the Blind. He's a critic of Isaac the Blind. Isaac the Blind was a Kabbalist who was affiliated with, somehow involved with the production of the Behir. His critic is this guy, Meir ben Simon, and he wrote about the Kabbalists. They boast in mendacious speeches and statements of having found confirmation and encouragement in the land of sages and scholars. But God save us from the sin of such heretical words. And we have heard that a book had already been written for them, which they called Behir, that is bright, but no light shines through it. This book has come into our hands, and we have found that they falsely attribute it to Rabbi Nehunya ben Hakana. God forbid. There is no truth in this. The language of the book and its whole content show that it is the work of someone who lacked command of either literary language or good style, and in many passages it contains words which are out-and-out heresy. So all throughout the Kabbalistic stream of thought, you'll find traditional Jews rising up and saying, this is evil. This is heresy. Don't believe it.
Now, is the claim that the Behir was handed down from its origins in the first century, or have they? Right. When was it actually written?
It was written, I think, it was like the 11th century in southern France.
Okay, again, that Cathar region.
Yes.
So just about the time the Crusades were taking place.
I was going to say, now, isn't this about the time that the Templars started absorbing some of this?
Right. Well, yeah, you have. This is before the Cathars were subdued, all right. And then, but also in next to southern France, you had a big community in Spain, a Jewish community, and this is where the next major publication of Kabbalistic thought came from, which was the Zohar. This is probably the one that most people are familiar with. It's really considered the Bible of the Kabbalah. But after the Cathar region was suppressed, a lot of the Jews fled into Spain, and I think that is when this the Zohar became written. And I, a lot of people say it's out and out, the creation of one man's imagination. I don't think so. I think it is probably a compilation of a lot of earlier teachings, but because this couldn't have come out of one person's imagination. There's just no way. But of course, you know, it's these higher critics who look at the literary style. What it is a 13th century writer just rewrote all the older texts that he had in his possession, and he obviously wrote it in the common vernacular of the day. This doesn't mean, though, that he created every teaching out of, you know, his imagination.
Mm-hmm.
Understand what I'm saying?
Yes, exactly. I think there are some who claim that he created everything out of whole cloth.
Right. That's what the secular critics say. But I think, he is just passing on teachings that he's collected bits and pieces here and there. But now the Zohar, that means, I'm using my own study as kind of a guide here.
I think so. It sounds perfect.
Yeah. Let's see here. Who is this guy? I should give the name of the... Okay, this is called the Sefer HaZohar, the Book of Splendor. Okay? Now, it says, the book itself claims that it was written in the 2nd century AD by Shimon Bar Yochai, who was a disciple of Rabbi Akiva, okay? Who was the original, you know...
The guy behind the Bar Kokhba revolt.
Yes.
Yeah.
Okay, and And let's see, I'm trying to look for a second for, okay, it's attributed to a Kabbalistic scholar, Moses de Leon, okay, in Spain. But what's interesting, though, is there is the Zohar's take on Israel's relationship, even humanity's relationship to these 70 fallen angels. And this goes back to the Tower of Babel incident, and everybody should be familiar with this. I mentioned it every time I'm on your show, and Michael Heiser, I know your listeners are familiar with Michael Heiser, they should be. But it goes back to the idea that after the Tower of Babel, the nations of the world were divided up according to languages, but also according to handed over to the spiritual, fallen spiritual authorities, the spiritual powers. And it goes back to that great text that Paul has in Ephesians chapter 6. When he says that our battle is not against flesh and blood, it's against the spiritual authorities, the cosmocrators, the powers of the world.
Mm-hmm.
Okay? But the Zohar looks at these 70 fallen angels and refers to them as the patron angels of the world. Okay? These are the angels that have authority over the world, over the nations of the world. But it paints them in a perspective, in a very positive perspective, as holy angels, okay? And it numbers Michael, the archangel, the holy archangel, as among them.
And okay? Gabriel, I think, and Raphael and Uriel.
Yes. So it's just very deceptive in this way, because Jesus makes it clear symbolically and in outright statements that these nations, or these angels and Satan himself, they've been judged, and they're evil, and they're gonna, like the prophet Isaiah says, the gods who did not make heaven and earth, they will perish from the earth. They're gonna be killed. And then, like it says in Psalm 82, they've been judged, and they will die like men do.
Mm-hmm.
So that's the ultimate, that's the final end that these angels will have.
So just to make the point really clear, what the Kabbalah has done is shown its practitioners the way to communicate with these 70 who have been placed over the earth by God after the fall of the Tower of Babel, the 70 fallen who rebelled against God and who've done everything in their power to destroy God's chosen people, Israel, once God called them out from called Abraham out from Ur. The Kabbalah is putting people in touch with the 70, the fallen.
Absolutely.
That's a key point that cannot be overstated.
Exactly, and we will repeat that in a little bit when we start talking about Washington, D.C. again.
Yeah. Now, we've discussed this before when we talked about the Giza discovery, Peter. The apparent contradiction between the 70 that are mentioned in Deuteronomy 32:8, God numbered, when he divided the people up according to their inheritance, he numbered them according to the number of the sons of God, and that's 70. But when you add up all of the, and you could probably you'll explain this better than I will, add up the different connections in the Kabbalah, you get 72.
Right. There's a switch there from focusing on the original 70 and changing it to 72. I think there are a number of reasons for this. Basically, the Kabbalists arrived at summer to 72 by adding Satan and Israel to the 70 to come up with 72.
I
think 72, the number was important for them because it was divisible by 12, and it was also allowed that the number to be brought into an astronomical connection mm-hmm. with the 360 degrees of the zodiac.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, 12 houses, 6 per house.
Yeah, right.
Also, there were 72 conspirators in the death of Osiris.
That's absolutely right. And you know that Osiris is the same as Dionysus. And if you know your Greek mythology, you know that there were actually two Dionysuses, okay? The original one was, according to the Greeks, was killed by the gods. And it's almost as if this original character, Osiris Nimrod, it's like he was a human sacrifice on behalf of the gods, whereas Jesus Christ, the true Messiah, was the sacrifice of God's only Son on behalf of mankind.
You know, that's really interesting, and honestly, I'm not sure how it dovetails in at this point, but just as an aside, I've been studying Mithraism.
Mithraism,
in addition to the
yes.
Kabbalah. And I find it interesting that Mithras is a god who did not die himself. He killed a bull, which
right.
could stand for Baal. I'm really not sure at this point. You may know better than I.
I have my own.
He sacrificed. In other words, he didn't spill his own blood. He spilled blood.
Right. But I still think that Mithra. This is just my own hypothesis. I haven't really gotten on and tested it yet. But I believe that Mithraism emerged from Persia and the Babylonian area. And I think it might go back to the time when Daniel became the chief of all the wise men, okay? Mm-hmm. He was the chief over all the pagan astrologers and divinators and all these guys at the capital in Babylon. And I think some of his predictions about becoming Messiah trickled down into paganism. And that's why I think you have so many, connections, superficial connections between the story of Mithra and the story of Jesus Christ.
Mm-hmm. That could be. I'm reading a lot about it right now, and we'll have you back for a discussion just on Mithraism.
Yeah.
Because I think it really is interesting, and I think it plays into some of the stuff we're seeing now, especially the fact that he wore a red cape and a red, Phrygian hat, just like the Pope had on at Christmas.
Oh, yeah.
So we've got this connection now with the 70 or the 70 fallen and Kabbalah. Now, where do we go from here? We've gotten to the 13th century, the Zohar. How have things developed since then, and how is the Kabbalah employed by, whomever's various secret societies or whatever for the purpose for those purposes?
Mm-hmm. Well, one of the best things that ever happened to the Kabbalah that added to its influence was the dispersion of the Jews from Spain. I think it was, what was the year? Was it 1492?
Ferdinand and Isabella drove the Jews out.
Ferdinand and Isabella, they expelled all the Jews out. They forcibly converted or expelled all the Jews. And this is where this big center of Kabbalistic study, all these guys were forced to leave. And they went all over to the main commercial centers, capitals of the world. And the Kabbalah was just dispersed all over the place from that time. And then this is also corresponds with the beginning of the Renaissance. And if you studied the Renaissance, you know that there's this whole idea of these Renaissance mages, okay? These guys like Nostradamus, like Ficino, Thomas Campanella, who else? There's a number of these guys, Giordano Bruno. All these guys, what happened is Christians became introduced to the Kabbalah. And then they tried to, it's interesting, you had all these people really in deep search of occult wisdom, and they all wanted to interpret it or use it according to their own traditions, but they're all heretics. And so it's funny, you have Christian occultists trying to convert Jewish occultists into faith in the Messiah, but it's still all revolving around the same heresy that you can use the angels, communicate directly with the angels mm-hmm. to get straight dope from God. You know what I'm saying?
You know, I'm glad you brought that up, because at this point, I just want to clarify, don't study this on your own, listeners, unless you are so grounded in the Word that you cannot be shaken, because this stuff is seductive.
Absolutely, it is.
Yep. And that's why these societies are so seductive, promising secret knowledge which leads to enlightenment right. mm-hmm. that is only for a special chosen few.
Exactly. It makes you feel really important, and it makes you feel like you got there on your own.
Yeah, and it empowers you. It is a very, very seductive lie. So now, again, what's been the influence of the Kabbalah and this idea that one can communicate directly with the spirit world with no directly to the spirit world?
Well, okay, it's a lot of it became centered in London. Okay, this became a major occult underground, and again, it goes back to the late Renaissance, the Northern European Renaissance, especially around the time of the Elizabethan Empire, and John Dee, who was the chief astrologer of Queen Elizabeth, okay? He was another guy who was totally wrapped up in the Kabbalah. He lived at the very end of Giordano Bruno's life, and they kind of really had the same... Giordano Bruno, by the way, was finally burned at the stake in Venice. But, and then it's what's interesting about him is he's got the Kabbalah in there, he's got Gnosticism and all this stuff, but then his form of true religion, he says, goes back directly to Egypt. For him, it's the ancient pagan Egyptian religion that is the true religion.
Mm-hmm.
It's a very interesting thing that seems like everything goes back to Egypt as far mm-hmm. as paganism is concerned. But John Dee, this guy is just very fascinating, and he worked through his seer was, I think his name was Edward Kelly, And Edward Kelly was the guy who saw the visions and heard the voices, and he explained to John Dee what he was seeing. And they worked in tandem doing their cult rituals, whatever it is, looking at the crystal ball or however they did it. But John Dee, through Edward Kelly, got the message that he was the chosen one. And there's this strange scene that Kelly describes to John Dee of Dee sitting in heaven, being enthroned in heaven and being crowned by the Archangel Michael himself, and being told that it is your mission to spread this new gospel, you know, the true gospel of God to the world. So
John Dee thought he was crowned by Michael?
Yes, he did. He absolutely did.
I'm interested now, how much influence did John Dee have on Queen Elizabeth in encouraging her to go out and send ships to colonize the rest of the planet?
Well, he was very influential. Another guy here was, who's the explorer? Sir Francis Drake.
Mm-hmm. Drake,
he was
yeah.
another guy that was very interested in the Kabbalah and this
oh,
whole
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
Didn't he write a book about Atlantis in the title. I can't remember it, and I mm-hmm. can't
well,
say
no,
I know what's
no,
in
you're
it.
Thinking of, you're thinking of Francis Bacon.
Francis Bacon. All right, I'm sorry.
Yes.
You're right. I'm confusing
oh, yes,
the Francis's.
But no, he's right there in the middle of this mix as well. Yeah, mm-hmm. and he's really one of the original Rosicrucians. So it all, you have this Kabbalistic, Masonic, Rosicrucian mix going on. And, yeah, they were in control of the governments of the world.
You know,
really.
that gives me chills. That gives me chills, Peter, because we have the Jews being kicked out of Spain in 1492, which every school child knows. 1492, yeah. Columbus sailed the ocean blue.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And in some ways, I think school children think of that as the birthday of the Americas, when we were,
right.
quote-unquote, discovered. Of course, we
right.
were known about far before then. But now we go to Elizabeth, who's sending ships over here, and it, in many ways, it's the birth of the new world order that takes
yeah.
place because of
right,
John
right.
Dee. And wasn't John Dee also the original 007?
That was his mystic number, 007,
right.
yeah.
That's right. That's right. Well, now in his he developed a system called Enochian magic. Okay, and this is where it translates into goes on down into the ages into black magic occultism that has emerged. That has gone all the way down into Aleister Crowley and then lately into recent guys like Lon-Miles Le Duquette. But he had this system where he was taught the language of the angels. Okay, it was a language that Enoch spoke. And he wrote it down. It's a very complicated system. I haven't tried to study it. I just can explain it. That's all. But very superficially explain it. But anyway, this became a really important. It's almost viewed as a scientific way in which by which to communicate with the angels. And yeah, like I said, John Dee created it, and it was passed down through this whole underground network. A 19th century guy by the name of Eliphas Levi, okay, he was a French-based guy who did a lot of study in London and had a lot of mystical experiences in London. I really think London was the global capital of occultism mm-hmm. by this time. I mean, mm-hmm. this was the headquarters of the British Empire, okay? It was a major, major important center. And, of course, this is where we have things like Darwinism coming from. Karl Marx
mm-hmm.
Wrote his ideas from London. You have all these all these things coming out of London. It's a very, very dark place to be. But, yeah, Eliphas Levi was another heavy-duty Kabbalist, Gnostic, Mason, Rosicrucian, what have you. And then Aleister Crowley, of course, believed that he was a reincarnation of Eliphas Levi.
Okay.
And he really does the same thing. And he threw out, up until Crowley, a lot of these guys really thought that they were still true Christians. Like, when you look at the Golden Dawn and the founders of the Golden Dawn organization, these three founders, they really believed that they were Christians. But they just had a higher understanding of what it really meant to be a mm-hmm. Christian, according to their view. But Crowley really threw it all out. And he had no use for Christianity. He equated Jesus Christ with Osiris, who was the Egyptian dying and rising god. He said they were one and the same. So he looked to the end of the age of Osiris, and he looked forward to the dawning of the age of Horus, who was the crown and conquering child who would, you know, come upon the world with vengeance and destroy mm-hmm. and thereby establish a new world order.
Which is the new age that the New Agers are looking forward to. It's dawning right,
right.
now.
Right.
So how is the Kabbalah guiding people who are involved in this sort of secret society back channel power play, the sort of situation. How do we wind up, in other words, with the Kabbalah's Tree of Life sort of apparently guiding the layout of Washington, D.C. in the 19th century?
Yeah, I think there was simply a very, very well-placed inner circle of occultists that were very much involved with the establishment of the United States of America. And again, it goes back to Francis Bacon's writing that book, The New Atlantis. And really, this whole story of Atlantis can be traced back to the Egyptians. And they said that their kingdom was founded by refugees from a great city that was destroyed. And I think, for me, it all points back to the original Babylon before the flood, which was Eridu. I think that Atlantis is talking about that original Babylon.
Yep, I think that's probably right on target, Peter.
Yeah, I mean, the biggest of the ziggurats, apparently, based on what they've discovered of the foundation at Eridu, it was there. Forget the ones they found at Uruk and, later Babylon. Eridu had the biggest of them all.
And it's
below the flood layer.
Yes.
So this was apparently an attempt to lay out Washington, D.C. so that it would be underneath the power of this symbolic representation of the 70 fallen angels.
That's what it seems to be, yeah. I mean, that's the conclusion I come to after seeing it. I don't think there's any way around it. To me, I've seen a couple of different, explanations of the layout. I've seen the square and compass on it. I've seen a six-pointed star or a five-pointed star. But now I've seen a layout of the Tree of Life on it. And I forget, the Washington Monument really seems to land on this the symbol of Yasod, which is like a fertility symbol, right?
Yes.
It kind of makes. And then the White House is like this, the middle symbol. Let me try and turn to it and find exactly what it is. But Washington seems to be Tiferet, most likely. And then you trace the very head of the Tree of Life, Keter, to the headquarters of the Masonic Temple.
Yes.
Scottish Rite Freemasonry.
Scottish Rite, yes.
That is amazing.
Yeah, the other two below Keter, I think, are DuPont Circle and Logan Circle.
Right. It seems like the paths converge.
Mm-hmm.
Right.
And, again, we aren't saying that this is definitely, absolutely stone cold lock certain that this is what was laying out there. But this is what the evidence is pointing to. And we're just trying to examine where the evidence leads and what conclusions we might be able to draw from the evidence.
Mm-hmm.
Considering that Washington, D.C. was laid out in the early 19th century, the Masonic headquarters was built about 100 years later, begun in 1911, finished 1915. It does seem that there was a long-term plan involved there.
It does, but we all three know that it isn't simply human beings doing this. There really are supernatural beings. Those fallen angels really are leading these people.
Well, and they exert an influence on the here and now. In reality, a lot of people like to they don't like that. Even a lot of Christians, they don't like to think that the fallen angels could have direct impact in our day-to-day lives, but.
Mm-hmm.
One of the books that I've read is by this one of the most popular cultists these days, Lon-Milo Duquette. His little biography called My Life with the Spirits, and some of the stories that he tells in there, he is in he's in constant communication with the spirits, and he sees their influence in every little thing. He is I pity him so much because he is so much at their mercy, and they have him wrapped around he's wrapped around their finger and. He really has to do all these rituals and stay in their good graces, or there will be retaliation. That's how it is. He's enslaved to the gods. Mm-hmm. He is. Pathetic.
Tom Horn has started a series of articles, which we're running at Watcher Magazine, also at his site, RaidersNewsNetwork.com, called The Rise of Angelic Rule, talking about how the government of the United States appears now to be governed by, or at least is being influenced by, these fallen, and he points to certain pieces of evidence, like the use of the of certain key phrases in speeches by President George W. Bush, fire in the minds of men,
right.
angel
in
the whirlwind,
yes,
things
yes.
of that
I've
nature.
I've read that piece. It's I hope he keeps writing on this subject because it is very interesting. He brings up some very important discoveries.
I
agree with his conclusion. Absolutely, it's increasingly becoming more and more apparent that global affairs, our foreign policy is being conducted by someone not of this world. It doesn't have our best interests in mind.
Well, you know, either I'm getting better at spotting it, or they're becoming more and more brazen, because when Nancy Pelosi quoted the Novus Ordo Seclorum in her speech, I just about fell off the couch.
Yeah.
And what's interesting, as somebody, you know, I've got access to news sources, networks at the radio station that we don't have access to here, and it was looking for an audio clip of her saying Novus Ordo Seclorum, which I would have saved for future reference. Couldn't find it anywhere. Couldn't find it. I did find a text of the speech, which is what I've sent around to a few people. But that was what motivated me to look up, what does Novus Ordo Seclorum really mean? Now, conspiracy theorists for years have thought, oh, well, it means New World Order. Or some have said, well, no, it means New Secular Order. Not quite what it means. It's essentially from a translation of a poem by Virgil. And there are a couple of different translations. And sadly, I didn't think far enough ahead to bring it with me to have it open in front of me. But essentially, the translation refers to a section of a poem by Virgil in which he says, now the order of the ages is begun anew. And
I have the email that you sent me, and the line here says, the ages mighty march begins anew.
Mm-hmm.
Is that the phrase here?
That's the phrase, but then what follows phrase is what's really interesting.
Yes.
Which is that...
Okay. I bookmarked it. I've got it archived at Watcher.
Yeah. Justice Returns...
Says, yes. Now come the Virgin, Saturn reigns again. Now from high heaven descends a wondrous race.
Mm-hmm.
And then it goes on, thou on the newborn babe who first shall end that age of iron, bid a golden dawn. Mm-hmm. So you have to understand this in the context of the Roman Empire, for which Virgil was writing this. He really looked to the Roman Empire as the fulfillment of this, you know, this pagan prophecy, I suppose. But and then we've repackaged this with our great seal of the United States, Novus Ordo Seclorum, and then it's amazing that our current politicians are still using this phrase that talks about the return. Saturn reigns again. And now I've done a little bit of study. With the first time I saw this, I was reminded of this book that I have by the great Sumerologist. His book is called, his name is Samuel Noah Kramer. The book that he wrote is called Myths of Enki, the Crafty God.
Mm-hmm.
And he has a whole section of a chapter called The Saturnine Way. And if we want to trace the origin of the Roman god Saturn, it ends up at Enki.
You begin with Enki. Yeah.
Yes, it all goes back to Enki, and it goes back to the Sumerians, who were the first people to create written language, the first people to write down literature and explain their view, their pagan view of how, you know, religion was and how the world was created, how mankind was created, our relationship with the gods. And yes, this was after the division of the nations, okay? So this was when they're totally under the authority of the fallen angels, and they're taking their knowledge of history from the fallen angels, and mm-hmm. they look to Enki as their savior figure.
So then, to summarize the translation again of this poem by Virgil, we get the role of circling centuries begins anew, justice returns, and returns old Saturn or Enki's reign with a new breed of men sent down from heaven. The Anunnaki, the fallen, the watchers. It is the wondrous race to which our leaders are beholden. I think, and I think Sharon agrees, that Nancy Pelosi's speech was deliberately calculated to send a message to those in the know that she is an insider, that she is playing ball.
Have no fear. I'm not going to upset the apple cart. Things will keep going according to plan.
Or maybe it was intended as a deliberate homage to the true powers behind the throne, as it were.
Right.
It's disgusting. It is no accident that the capital of the United States, America, the new Atlantis, if you will, is sitting right on Virginia and Maryland, the Virgin Maryland.
Mm-hmm.
the goddess.
Yeah, with the Kabbalistic tree right over the layout of the town. And
right.
it there is so much going on there right now that is affecting every one of us. You, me, Derek, everybody, people in Iraq, people
yeah.
in Iran, people. And who is the one making the decisions? You think it's George Bush, don't you?
Mm-hmm.
No, it's the fallen angels behind whatever is driving the people in Washington.
Right. And the point that we want to make clear is that this is not a Democratic-Republican thing. Nancy Pelosi's speech is evidence of that. But anyone who thinks that this is the fault of one man or one political party, it's all the Republicans, it's all those conservative Christians who voted for George Bush, are sadly mistaken. They're not getting the picture. This is just one nation among many, albeit the most powerful nation in the world right now. But God placed the entire world, except for the one people that he pulled out, that he chose for his own, under the rule of these fallen. The whole world is a battleground of these fallen who are struggling between themselves for power and for supremacy amongst themselves, as they themselves collectively challenge the authority of God. And this is just one more bit of evidence to it. And like again, Peter, your work connecting the Divine Council, the 70, to the Kabbalah was brilliant. I've not seen that done anywhere else.
It is amazing. It is amazing. You know, Peter.
My piece meanders here and there, but I do get back to the point. It's a really long study. It seems like every time I got sidetracked, I pursued that to the end. But I apologize for that. But people should still take a look at it. There's definitely some very, very important information in there.
We highly recommend reading that. Well, actually, we highly recommend reading anything you write, because I really think that you are just finding stuff that is fresh. It's a fresh perspective on material, on information that's been there for us all along. And it's very easy as Christians to just sort of sit back and say, okay, well, I learned this when I was a kid, and that came from my grandparents, and that came from my great-grandparents, and I'm not going to change because that's the way it is. But when, in fact, I think that God is not giving new revelation, he's just giving new eyes to people looking
he's
at it.
He's clarifying the same material that we've had around for so long, and we're looking at it with fresh eyes, and mm-hmm. suddenly it's all making sense.
Mm-hmm.
Well, and what people like you and Mike Heiser and Patty Heron and David Lowe and other authors are doing.
David Duncan.
People who are, and Beth Vey, people who are not necessarily published by major publishing houses. The most original thinking in Christian research and study being done today, Peter, is being done by people who are self-publishing.
Yeah, and it's not coming out of, you know, major theologically focused universities.
Exactly
no,
right. Exactly
is.
Right. And what you are doing collectively, to borrow a phrase from Mike Heiser, is re-mythologizing the Bible, because centuries of study into the Bible have pulled the supernatural elements out of it. It is amazing that the vast majority of Christians in America, anyway, and probably around the world, would say, yes, I believe in God, I believe in Jesus Christ, who rose from the dead, you know, et cetera, et cetera. But then we'll just refute, just reject out of hand the concept of, say, creationism, because, well, it doesn't. You can't explain that with science. It is astounding. I can't believe in ghosts because the supernatural doesn't exist. That all stopped after the first century. It's just unbelievable.
Peter, can we get back to the Kabbalah for a minute?
Yes.
Again, I've just started reading about it, so I'm very new, and I have no intention to get deeply into it because, again, it's creepy stuff. I always feel like I have to take a shower.
Once you get a handle on it from the beginning, you know where it hits.
Well,
so
and that's
really...
all you need to know. Can you tell us, my understanding is that there are 32 paths, which I find really interesting because there's a 32nd degree of Freemasonry, and then above that,
right.
of course, the mystical 33rd and probably beyond, but there are supposedly 32 paths on it. Can you explain that to us?
Yeah, well, the 32 paths are supposedly the 22 letters of the Hebrew alphabet plus the 10 sephirot of the Tree of Life. That makes up the 32 paths. That's the explanation I've heard.
Isn't it interesting that 22 is one of those occult numbers, those insider neocon numbers that keeps popping up?
Mm-hmm.
And another bit of information I found in your article, can you explain how the Kabbalists come up with the idea that God has 72 names incorporated within his name? And what those names are?
Yes, I might have to. It's escaped me, but it comes from one of these biblical texts. I think it's a 3-verse text from the Old Testament. Each of these verses is made up of 24 letters, I believe, mm-hmm. and there are therefore eight three-letter words in each verse. Anyway, the 72, basically they take these three verses, 72 letters long, and divide, and they make all the 24 names of three letters each. So, I might have had this mixed up, but it's in my study. But again, they twist Old Testament texts that seem to have, you know, they see these texts and they say there has to be a mystical explanation for this, and then they add to it their own interpretation.
And what they've done, if I understand correctly, then, is they say that those 72 names are the names of the 72 angels.
72 angels. Well, okay. Now, this gets off on some very interesting stuff, because according to some of these Kabbalistic texts, this goes back to King Solomon. He was supposedly a very big Kabbalist who was into channeling, conjuring angels and demons. But legend has it that he conjured the 72 demons, and he put them to work helping him to build a temple. Okay, this story is found in a couple of occult works called the Lesser Key of Solomon and the Key of Solomon. These were very important. They're like foundational documents of the Golden Dawn.
Huh, okay.
And they used this, they used this 72-letter name of God, the Shem HaMepharash, which means name of extension. Okay? So there's like, you have the, really they look at what Solomon did as applying to, you know, fallen angels or demons. Then they look at the contrast that with the Shem HaMepharash, which are supposedly the holy angels. But there's a section in the Lesser Key of Solomon called Ars Goetia, which is really on sorcery. It's about how to summon these demons. And so these the demons, the angels of the Goetia are known as the evil angels. The Shem HaMepharash are known as the good. But the fact is, they're one and the same. They're one and the same. They're the very same angels.
And so basically,
this is really part of an elaborate occult system, and Alain Milo Duquette goes on and on about it. He's got diagrams and you know, explains step by step the means of how to use this stuff. But it's all based on contact with the fallen angels, totally forbidden and against Judaism and Christianity as well.
Absolutely.
You know, it reminds me of our two-party system. They're Democrats and Republicans, but frankly, they're the
very
same.
Very good analogy.
All the same, yeah. And it boils down to, it leads to another conclusion that they draw too, which is heretical, in that the evil angels, the evil nature, is part of God's nature, which of course is antithetical to Christian doctrine and Christian
teaching.
Right,
that's another one of the points that are made. Yeah, the Kabbalah works both ways. It tries to portray God as evil, and on the other hand, it tries to portray Satan as a holy agent of God's will, you know, which is certainly Satan is limited mm-hmm. as far as what he can do, but he does not act within the will of God. So, I mean, it's hard to, we can get into the talk about predestination or what have you, but the point is God is not the immediate author of evil. This, the responsibility of Satan, he had free will and he's chosen to abuse it.
Right, and so again, it just makes it, we just want to make it clear that this is all heretical and antithetical to mm-hmm. Christian doctrine, Judaic doctrine. Even Islamic scholars teach against this sort of divination, trying to contact the spirits.
You know, I think it's really important right now that we speak to parents who are listening. I can guarantee you your teenage kids and preteen kids are exposed to this. I was exposed to this when I was a preteen and a teen.
I've seen so many references to this just on like the Cartoon Network and some mm-hmm. of these disgusting new cartoons that are being created that mm-hmm. I see my kids watching every once in a while. And I got to, you know, take the clicker from them and mm-hmm. turn it back to football. But anyway, yeah.
It's everywhere. And because it's everywhere, the assumption is that stuff is all part of reality. And so when they're told, you know what, there are paths to heaven, and you go through this, you go on this quest, it's no different than what they have watched their entire lives.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's an indoctrination, a way of getting to kids mm-hmm. through the form of entertainment that appeals to them most, which is always how Satan works with all of us.
But more than that, I can guarantee you that in secret places, on the playground, behind stairwells, maybe even outright in the hallways, kids are being told, you know what, I just read the coolest book. They might even be sharing this information at church meetings. Because Christians, just because your kids are Christians, doesn't make them immune.
Right. Yep, and it needs to be understood from the standpoint of gathering intelligence on what the enemy is doing. That's why we look at this stuff, not to try to glorify it, not to examine it and experiment with it ourselves, but to understand the ways in which the enemy, and it's not just one, not just Satan, there are at least 70 that we're dealing with, try to seduce us and draw us away. Yeah. Peter, again, for people who want to read more of your work, where did they go?
RedmondRising.com, and I would suggest this article. I have the Council, the Divine Council and the Kabbalah, and also my series is called The Giza Discovery. I think it's part 6, that I also talk about the Kabbalah quite a bit, because it all ties together.
You know, it's amazing. You can read those things for free at your website, which I praise you for. Thank you so much for providing that information to us for free.
Yeah, it is an amazing work, and I find the arguments that you put forward very compelling. Your mm-hmm. research, especially in going forth in documenting things rather than just making assertions, is really helpful to people who have trouble accepting things on face mm-hmm. value, like me.
Because you document it, it's clear that you put in a lot of work.
Yeah. Well, hopefully, you know, it'll spur other people to continue on with the research, because I wish I had a lot more time, but I do have a regular job. I work for a living. And
yep.
So
we totally relate to that.
Oh, yes.
But this is a wonderful site to help you understand better the true nature of the universe. That's redmoonrising.com, the website of author and researcher Peter Goodgame. Peter, hang on the line with us for just a second here while we wrap up. If you have any questions for us, or if you'd like us to pass something along to Peter, you can always drop us an email at radio@peeringintodarkness.com.
Or you can send us individual notes, Sharon@peeringintodarkness.com, or, of course, Derek@peeringintodarkness.com. We strongly encourage you to go to redmoonrising.com, check out Peter's work, buy the book. Red Moon Rising is well worth the price of admission.
Yes, a fresh look at the prophetic timeline of the apocalypse. So we've got that in there, too.
Mm-hmm.
We'll be back tomorrow with another half-hour blather on the news and events of the day. Until then, I'm Derek Gilbert.
I'm Sharon Gilbert. Bye-bye, everyone.
Radio.
They're coming from the darkness. Over 6,000 years ago, the citizens of Mesopotamia encountered them.
Down through time, tens of thousands of people on every continent of the world have etched their likeness on the walls of caves, chiseled statues of them from solid stone, and prayed prayers to their highest gods to be delivered from them.
But prophecy says they will return, and at a time when Babylon, modern Iraq, and Iran is invaded and destroyed. This spring, exclusively from RaidersNewsUpdate.com, we'll tell you what you need to know about them. In the book-length ebook, Stargates, Ancient Rituals, and Those Invited Through the Portal.
Catherine Adamson thought she was going back to her quiet hometown of Eden, Indiana, to settle the affairs of her late Aunt Celeste. Instead, she discovers that Eden has literally gone to hell. Two high school students have disappeared, leaving behind only a running car and a bloody shoe. Strange lights have appeared over the town, and the fields of a local farm are marked with blackened circles. Eden County Hospital reports record births, incredibly large babies joining the ranks of a growing number of giants. Many of Eden's leading citizens have been hiding evil secrets, but their behavior has been closely watched by the mysterious Dr. Apollo Bell, head of the Mount Hermon Institute. All of Eden is a war camp, and citizens must choose sides in an eternal battle. Catherine is reunited with her old flame, Joshua Carpenter, the publisher of the Eden Chronicle, and they quickly learn their strongest ally may be John Thundercloud, a legless old Winnebago Indian who spends his days writing line after line in a library full of tattered diaries. It's Winds of Evil by Sharon K. Gilbert, book one of the Laodicea Chronicles, available now online and at bookstores everywhere.